Welcome to the PeopleStack podcast, where we discuss the intersection of people, work, and technology. I'm your host, Jen Bunk, founder of Jen Bunk Ventures and creator of PeopleStack Academy. My guest for this episode is Matthew Mausner, founder and CEO of Woxer. Welcome, Matthew.
Thank you.
How are you doing today?
I am good.
Great, great. So let's kick things right off. Tell us a little bit about Woxer and what you're working on right now.
So Woxer actually started as a zoom-in pivot from a previous project, which was a wiki for controversy. Wikis are great for fact, but they're not very good at handling situations where people don't agree on what they're disagreeing about, mostly because nuance is lost and because we're stuck in a two-sided paradigm in most of Western thinking. So we came up with a multi-column, multi-threaded database that would show many sides of an issue. And we never really solved the problem of whether it was an input tool or an output tool or a database or a multimedia, hold live discussions, transcript, write them up, have online live contributions, and then edit them. And we really bottlenecked on the editing. So we came up with this idea to sort this giant pile of posts and comments, which was to have our participants themselves do the, basically we crowdsourced the editing by asking our participants to tell us whether something was a fact or an opinion, whether it was central or peripheral. And the way we chose to do that was to wrap around each post this new kind of widget thing that we invented. So we showed that to our advisor and he said, scrap the entire rest of the project and just do this widget thing. And that's what became Woxer.
Yeah.
So Woxer is basically a multi-dimensional way of rating multi-dimensionally.
Okay. Great.
Which actually sounds a lot more complicated than it is. It's a way of wrapping three or more or less, but usually three scales, sliding scales around each piece of content or question or post. And each of those scales allows you to modify or emphasize or put context to the other scales. So you can say you like something or you don't, how strongly you feel about it, and in what context.
For example. Yeah. So I'm going to tell a little bit about the story about how we met and how you pitched it to me, because I still remember when we met. It was at the MassTLC Unconference. So it was one of these conferences that wasn't really a conference. It was, everybody was in a huge room. There were two circles, inner circle, outer circle, and it was basically like speed dating for business people. And you got to talk to people for like, what was it, something like a minute or something.
30 seconds,
ridiculous.
I think.
It was a ridiculously short amount of time. So you have a ridiculously short amount of time to pitch it. And I still remember the first thing you said to me is, hi, I'm Matthew. I make surveys that don't suck. And I said, hi, I'm Jen. I used to be a survey researcher. And I was like, oh, wow, we should we should talk more. So talk to us a little bit more about the building surveys that don't suck. So what sucks about existing surveys and what is Woxer doing differently?
Well, we realized that that's what we had eventually. And actually, I was at a similar conference. I was at the MIT CIO Symposium when I had literally 5 or 10 seconds to pitch to people. I mean, in very brief networking sessions. So I boiled it down to the absolute minimum that would catch people's attention and speak to their pain point. So what is a survey? I mean, since 1952 or 1922, it's a way of asking people what they think. And back in those days, the way that they did that was they would usually either ask you to check off a multiple choice or fill in a, you know, a number on a 1 to 10 scale, or ask you to write out an answer, or occasionally, you know, check off a binary, yes, no, or a checkbox.
Right.
As far as I can tell, virtually all online feedback and survey tools, while they have embedded themselves in our lives in an incredible variety of annoying and intrusive ways, they have not changed the fundamental structure of what it means to ask a question. So digital format, I mean, when you're looking at a screen, you're inherently looking at something graphic where there is a vertical and a horizontal dimension and even a sense of depth. And none of the surveys that exist take advantage of that in any meaningful way. And we decided to. So the way that I would say they suck, I mean, I'm not, nobody seems to push back when I make that rather unbusinesslike statement that says, you know, something else sucks.
Yes.
Nobody says, well, no, they don't.
Right.
They do. Everyone hates taking them. There are at least three or four ways that I think that they, you might say, crush the human potential of who's looking at the screen. They force you to collapse your opinion into a binary or into a 1 to 5. They force you out of analog brain into digital brain. If I have to think how much I like this, and then I have to think, is that a 7 or an 8, instead of just striking a place along a visual oomphness scale, it's literally easier. It takes less cognitive load.
Yes.
And also, when you're asked to collapse your opinion into one, even if it's a fairly nuanced single scale, that is actually a more difficult cognitive task than when you are able to modify it with the contextual or emphasis type of, I mean, it's not always exactly context or emphasis, but humans are three-dimensional, reality is three-dimensional, and your opinions are usually three-dimensional.
Right. Yep. So it helps feed into that reality. And as you were talking about scale points, one thing that came to mind was I went to a talk, a conference one time, and it was a Googler talking about how they were measuring performance at Google. And she had mentioned something about they're really happy because they went down from something like a 51-point scale or something ridiculous like that down to something much more traditional, like I think it was a 5-point scale. But as you were just talking right now, it's like I was like, oh, yeah, you know, that's so much better. 5 points or 7 points, 3 points would even be better than that. And, or at least that's that tends to be the conventional wisdom now. Fewer points is better. But when you were just talking, like, yeah, maybe more points or no points at all, where it's just, yeah, it's somewhere around here. I don't want to have to choose a 3 or a 7 or a 51. I want to just kind of shoot it somewhere in the area. So that's essentially what you guys are going
to do. Yes and no. We have our cake and eat it too. Our scales are, it's just a sliding bar, which has slightly longer bars towards each end. When you touch it, the slider appears. And for about a second and a half, there's just that slider. So if you want to move on and stay in analog brain to the next scale and the next scale, you can do that. But we actually have, we are capturing nuance up to 100 points. It's a 100-point scale. And the reason we do that is because, well, for a couple of reasons. For one thing, it allows you to drill into very nuanced, detailed data. But also because, so we don't show the end user the percent until about a second and a half after they touch it. So that if they are the type who is prone to fine-tuning their responses, a 1 to 100 sounds like an incredibly and unnecessary amount of detail.
Yeah.
But every one of us that is going to be involved in this conversation or heard this conversation has been to school. And when you're in school, you get grades. You know what the difference between a 74 and an 81. You're used to giving those grades, and often you're used to, or I should say, you're used to getting those grades, and chances are if you're a grad student, you gave those grades as well.
Right.
You know the difference between 74 and an 81. If you're a sports fan, you know 74% is a much poorer foul shooter than an 81% foul shooter.
Right.
So for the purposes of analysis, you can certainly slice our data into quintiles, into halves, into deciles. You can you can simplify it to a 5-point scale if you want to.
Sure.
But because we capture both the initial reading and if someone modified it, you can tell, A, whether people are on the OCD end of how they rate, but also there's a significant difference. Oh, no, it's not a 72. It's actually an 89. I feel really strongly about this.
Okay.
And those numbers are still meaningful to people. Hmm. Humans have 10 fingers. They have 10 toes. They're used to thinking in tens.
Sure.
And they're used to getting grades. So we find it's useful on both ends.
Yeah, yeah.
But we don't force you into it.
Sure, sure. And I hadn't realized that you capture that, what you refer to as the OCD piece of it, or basically you capture the initial and then, oh, I wanted to change this.
Oh, it's fun.
Like, that would be some fun data to look at, because just that alone.
That alone, just the fact that someone modifies their scale. There's another piece that we noticed pre and post behavior is We feed back to the user the average of everybody else's ratings, and in some mm-hmm. cases we feed mm-hmm. back to them the entire range. We never show them the average before they rate.
Right.
So in you know, the behavior of crowds and peer pressure, so to speak, how much are people influenced by knowing what other people did?
Yes.
There are certain contexts where it is highly relevant, in other cases completely not. But in terms of like fashion, for example, if you think something is really nice and then you look and everybody else thought it was kind of heinous, you might change your answer.
Yes. Yeah.
Some other cases where you have a strong political opinion, same thing, or sometimes it makes you even more extreme.
Mm-hmm.
So these are all the nature of the interaction that we provide for people mm-hmm. allows for the researcher to find out all sorts of interesting things about the subcategories of the people, but it allows the end user to have a meaningful, I mean, the whole point here, the biggest word is that it's a meaningful experience, that I'm able to express myself in context
mm-hmm.
and then in where it's relevant, I'm able to see how I related to the rest of the survey takers of that context.
Right, right. So I know you've done some political surveys and some other stuff. And so what? So have you had a chance to crunch the numbers, like say on the political survey or any recent surveys, and been able to find anything interesting?
Well, yes. I mean, there's a ton of interesting things. It's the most interesting. So one of the reasons I like to collaborate with people like you, who are both academic and or used to a more abstract way of thinking, is that I get interested in the content.
Yeah.
The political stuff, for me, I'm really interested in, okay, if I just look at liberals, what do they actually think about gun rights?
Mm-hmm.
Do they even know much about guns, which was a question we asked. Do they want to own a gun? Well, conservatives overwhelmingly want to own a gun to protect themselves. Liberals overwhelmingly don't. It was the single biggest differentiator.
Mm-hmm.
Then there was another question, which was almost as big of a differentiator, which is liberals might want. So we asked a scale that went from I might want to be ready to overthrow unjust government to overthrow the government, are you nuts?
Yeah.
Liberals overwhelmingly were at the overthrow the government, are you nuts? Like 90-something percent.
Mm-hmm.
Conservatives were split about 50-50. About 50% of conservatives went way to the end of the scale that said, yes, I might want to be ready to resist or overthrow unjust government.
Mm-hmm.
And 50% mm-hmm. of them wouldn't. But, I mean, it was just utterly fascinating to me, that breakdown in terms of the rationale behind this political hot button issue.
Right. And you asked a variety of things. So it looks like, it sounds like one of the main goals was to try to figure out where the big differences are between the liberals and the conservatives. And so you asked a bunch of stuff, and those were the two places where you saw clear lines drawn between those two groups, whereas there was other
questions. It was the biggest differentiation. Well, and yeah. I should mention, so we asked people how they self-identified. Democrat or Republican, sliding scale. Republican or conservative, sliding scale. Strongly affiliated to not very strongly affiliated.
Yes.
Sliding scale. So each, we have a filtering tool on our dashboard, so you can pick any one or two or three scales or other non-walks data that you collected and use those to filter the answers of another set of scales.
Mm-hmm.
So we're able to take the set of answers of how people self-identified and then filter the gun rights question or the immigration question by whether people self-identified as X, Y, or Z.
Sure.
Or literally
sure.
X, Y, or Z.
Got it. So it was the, what was it again? You want to own a gun versus you don't want to own a gun. Was that how it was asked specifically? It was about ownership. It was about gun ownership.
Well, it was the so to speak, framing question in the middle just said, gun rights.
Okay.
And then one scale was, I would like to own a gun to protect myself, to, how would owning a gun protect, I forget the exact wording of the other end of the scale, but how would owning a gun protect me?
Right.
And then another scale was, I know a lot about firearms, too. I don't know much about guns. And even the use of the word is very striking. Conservatives and those who really know a lot about firearms, they call them firearms. They don't call them guns.
Yes.
If you're even saying the word guns, you probably don't know what you're talking about.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. Yeah.
And the linking it to this idea of being willing to stand up to the government in America is very fascinating, because when you look at the world, it's actually overwhelmingly left-wing insurgencies who actually do, in reality, pick up guns and fight against unjust governments.
Yes.
So I find it really fascinating about identification. It's almost like, I would never do that unless it was so unjust that I absolutely have to. That's like the subscript footnote to this liberal saying, oh, I would never pick up a gun to resist or overthrow a government.
Right.
Well, exactly. Except that when I do, it would be from such a sense of utter self-righteousness that I might be willing to do it and throw a good, fun communist revolution and kill a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
So I find it sort of, you know, there's a deeper layer there that you could pull out if you really wanted to get into the heart of people's motivations.
Between the lines, right. Mm-hmm. And that's what the Vox does, right? That it allows you to get that nuance that you can't get with a 5 or 7 point Likert scale.
I believe it does. I believe it gets to the why. I believe it gets to the meaningful context and the emphasis underneath what people think by giving them a vehicle to express something that's more authentic than just a 1 to 10 scale.
Right. And I think the other thing that is interesting about what you're doing is that it's going against the standard anchors, the strongly disagree, strongly agree, or like the frequency anchors, to make them up, right? You know, you have that freedom now. Okay, you have a scale, and it's technically a 100-point scale, but label these the way that people are really thinking about it, as opposed to, do I strongly agree or strongly disagree? You know, how much do we think, maybe we do, but you know, how much do we always think about how much I strongly agree or strongly disagree with a particular statement? You know, through the normal course of our lives, a lot of us probably don't think like that. We think like, never ever would I own a gun, or yeah, absolutely I would. That's just the way that. And so, I think that's what makes it interesting and easier for people to fill out, but also allows you that nuance that we were talking about.
Yes. I mean, we don't necessarily write the scales, meaning our clients write the scales.
Yeah.
We suggest, and we nudge, and we encourage them to get out of the language of strongly agree, disagree, or whatever, because survey fatigue is like a society-wide phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
And this goes into a larger kind of platitude fatigue, cliche fatigue. You know, part of the reason, I'll get a little political here for a second, part of the reason that these outsider candidates, whether it was Bernie or Trump, got so much traction in this election is because neither one of them was playing the usual political platitude game.
Sure.
They were saying things that seemed more authentic, whether they were or not, you know, that's not my business.
Mm-hmm.
But people are completely burned out on the same cliches, the same jargon, the same platitudes. And when it comes to surveys, people are burned out across the board. The answer when you ask someone, would you like to take a survey, is no.
Right.
If you ask them, hey, could you please rip us a new one? Well, they might say yes. Well, that's a whole different. I mean, relate to them as human beings. Don't relate to them as like, hey, I'm going to suck your brain for data.
Right.
Because I need to do it for market research.
Yes.
You know, if you want to do a paid market research survey, what you're going to get is a paid market research survey. And who is going to take money to answer market research? Like, you're biasing and jaundicing your data by the nature of how you're asking
and the nature of the people who are going to take that kind of survey too.
Exactly. And I think that the other kinds of surveys, if it's a survey at all, if you use that word at all, you're already pre-selecting people who are willing to answer a survey. So who's willing to answer a survey? That's a very unique subset of the population that I don't think is representative of the group that you're probably trying to research.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, either you're incentivizing them, which biases them in a different way.
Right.
Or you are forced to grapple with the data set of the people who were willing to answer a survey.
Yes. I'm letting the weight of what you just said really trickle down, because I'm a former academic. I'm a former survey researcher. There are tons of us in the world who are basing our recommendations and our thoughts about the way society works on survey data. And based on the responses of these surveys that we're building in these certain ways with these certain kinds of people. And it's always kind of, it's like the elephant in the room, you know, and it's, and what's interesting, thinking back to my years as an academic, is the students, they pick up on it like that. They're like, can we really generalize, you know, like we learn about generalizability, right? Mm-hmm. You know, can you really generalize this to a broader population? Like, maybe, maybe not, but you know, and I did it. I am guilty as charged, you know, kind of brush that aside, but let's pretend we can, right? But.
Because this is all the data that we have.
Yeah, exactly. That's really where I'd end up. But we have to work with what we have.
And both in academia and in market research and psychology and all of that data that lies behind the data, once people are used to a certain way of looking at data, mm-hmm. once they're used to generalizing from a set of 5-point scales,
yep.
once they're used to adjusting their behavior based on feedback from these imperfect tools,
yes,
it becomes a self-reinforcing or self-fulfilling prophecy,
mm-hmm.
and they can't even conceive that they could get better data.
Right.
But then there are snake oil salesmen or grad students, I'm not sure which is worse, who will do incredibly lovely data science workups about the deeply implied significance and statistical significance and standard deviations based on this crappy survey data. And I'll show you, I mean, once you do a survey of 1 to 10s, you know, your standard, okay, please answer these 31 questions from mm-hmm. 1 to 10. I get these surveys all the time. They yeah. pop up even on NFL.com or Qualtrics throws them at you.
Yep.
31 in a row. I'll show you that even by the 11th, 12th, 13th question, you could put, how likely are you to eat human flesh on a scale from 1 to 10?
Yes.
And people will still answer 7 because at that point, they're already, their eyes have glazed over.
Mm-hmm.
It's like the, mm-hmm. it's like, you know, seeing a stop sign spelled S-O-T-P, your brain won't even notice it.
Sure.
So, you know, it's not just that people are burned out on surveys. It's that the format itself is not, it's like literally, you know, it goes back to the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. It's humans trying to fit themselves into a machine paradigm. Mm. So Voxer seeks to, and part of the reason people love smartphones is people love just touching and sliding. They don't want to
right.
sit down and write and digitize their experience.
Yeah.
They want it to happen very organically. And so Voxer, which works in my opinion, I mean, it's the same process sliding a mouse around as opposed to touching and sliding, but on mm-hmm. a touch screen, it's so much quicker and more elegant that you can just
yes.
be like,
yeah.
I'm against this, I'm for this, but not that strongly or this strongly. But I don't, the length of time it took me for me to even babble out that process describing what waxing is
yep.
took more time than it would take to wax.
Yes, yeah. That's a good way of describing it. Like, hey, let me just show you, click, 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 you're done. You just answered 3 questions. And yeah.
But it felt like one question.
But it felt like one because they're all related to one another,
yes.
right? And so let's talk about the process a little bit. So yes, Voxer surveys are different. I've experienced it myself. We've worked on some surveys together. But let's talk about that because some of the process of it in terms of like writing the questions, you know, writing your Vox scales and actually looking at the data and making sense of the data. The steps are still the same, even though they may be a little bit different because we're talking about a different way of asking and it's a different kind of data. So let's talk about that a little bit. And the one thing that I'm actually most interested in your perspective on after working on this with several folks is where the hurdles tend to be. Because like for me, it tends to be toward the beginning where like you just want to jump right into, oh, let's write questions. Like, hang on a second. What's the overall goal here first? And sometimes it's hard to get over that initial hurdle. But then if you can do that, then the questions just come like that. It's kind of like marketing. Like once you have your goal, like this is my target market, this is what I'm trying to sell, then the marketing just quote unquote writes itself. So that's the hurdle that I've experienced is don't just sit down and write questions. You got to take a step back first.
I agree. So my background, I've been a management consultant and I've also done, I helped do an employee 360 at Goldman Sachs. Now that's probably the most formative experience. Well, that and I also helped do the reality TV show websites for MTV and VH1 where the voting helped determine who got to appear on television.
Mm-hmm.
So you might say the top and the bottom I got to work with, but both of them were formative. But in terms of management consultant, you know, the cliche lesson that we learned was, you know, NASA and the Russians were both trying to figure out how to solve these problems in space. And ballpoint pens didn't work. They had to invent a new kind of pen that had a zero-point thing so that it would still work. And NASA spent $4 million in the 1960s working this out. The Russians used a pencil. So sometimes you need to figure out what's the problem you're actually trying to solve. And so I push all my clients to just cut away all the BS and all of the ways that you're used to just getting a little piece of data to support whatever thesis.
Yes.
What do you really need to know? What's your bottom line? And mm-hmm. how is doing this going to help you get to your bottom line? Mm-hmm. You need to figure out, are people buying your thing? Or are they using your service? Or how can you improve your service? What is this thing that's going to affect your bottom line? Mm-hmm. And then what are the components that drive that? You know, mm-hmm. we want our clients to write their own boxes, mm-hmm. but they need help because it's a new medium. It is not just simply a way to just wrap Likert scales around something. It has a sort of necessary thinking component to mm-hmm. be able to think about information or human opinion in, so I'll use big words to describe something really simple. The most important thing that I've found is disaggregation, is to separate out related dynamics. So rather than just saying, you know, I love this, I would buy it, I need it, you know, these are each separate things, and market researchers' tendencies is to lump them into one. You know, how much do you love this new fabric or this new dress or whatever? But it's not, it all depends on the context. I wouldn't wear it to work, but I might wear it to play.
Yes.
I wouldn't wear it, but it looks great on the model.
Mm-hmm.
Or it would look great on my daughter. I mean, each of these need a context to be expressed accurately.
Yes, right.
Mm-hmm. So to write a question means to step back and think about what are the components of the question? What's going to allow me to answer this accurately? Mm-hmm. What context or emphasis? Mm-hmm. You know, for the politics, we asked three related questions with a big picture of smokestacks. And do I think there's too much pollution in the world? Am I willing to change my behavior to make there be less pollution in the air and water? Mm-hmm. And do I think humans are causing global warming or not?
Right.
So conservatives overwhelmingly believe there's too much pollution in the world, are absolutely willing to change their behavior, but they don't necessarily believe it's causing global warming. To me, this means that the entire environmental movement needs a giant slap upside the head.
Yeah.
From a basic marketing perspective, their messaging sucks.
Yes.
Stop. If you every time you say global warming, you make the earth get warmer by 1 degree.
Because they're not going to change their... is that what you're saying?
Because the messaging is wrong. I'm saying they have a very easy, hot button push that gets 90-something percent of the conservatives on board. Conservatives, no less than liberals, don't want the air and water poisoned.
Yeah, right.
But when you try to tell them that, therefore, it's because of this weird global warming thing, and then behind that, there's a political motivation, they're afraid of Al Gore becoming the world dictator.
Yeah. It's almost like, stop making it so complicated.
Yes.
Let's boil this down to, there are areas where very different kinds of people can agree.
Let's separate out the variables.
Yeah.
And you know, that's a very politicized example, but if you don't separate out the variables, you wind up with a lot of stupidity and a lot of inept policy and a lot of companies going down the wrong roads.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we did a big project for BMW, and we were looking at a lot of features related to automated driving.
Yes.
And BMW, like a lot of the major car companies, has incredible technology that can make your car speed up and slow down in traffic, can see pedestrians coming from even behind objects. They're using LiDAR and all sorts of sensing technologies.
Mm-hmm.
It is amazing. But BMW drivers are a unique subset of the world of drivers.
Yes.
These are people who, you know, they have their own messaging, and it's been effective, the ultimate driving machine.
Yes.
People who buy a BMW as opposed to buying a Lexus or hiring a chauffeur are people who love driving themselves. And if you're going to try to sell them on a car that's going to take the wheel away from you, I mean, what are you doing?
Yes.
So, you know, showing them that nuance, disaggregating those separate pieces. Yes, mm-hmm. I want technology that'll make me safer, but no, I don't want to lose the experience of driving myself. If you don't separate those out, you're not. If you don't ask the right question, you're not going to get the right answer.
Mm-hmm. Right, right, and that's how survey data can lie, because it's wrong all the time, because you're not asking the right questions. You're asking them. You're leading. They're leading questions. They're questions that are based on assumptions that may be false.
Correct. And the Voxer format does not insulate you against asking the wrong questions. Mm-hmm. You're always going to have to write intelligent questions. But by forcing you to put contextualized multiple questions into one question, it almost inherently forces you to become more objective. Mm-hmm. Because if all of your scales are positive to negative, you actually, we strongly recommend that at least one of the scales have no positive to negative connotation.
Interesting.
Because that's what allows
you. Like good, bad, is that what you mean?
Bad, more or less.
Okay.
Sometimes you just need a scale that says where to work or where to play.
Yeah.
There's nothing wrong with wearing a dress to work.
Mm-hmm.
Or wearing it to play,
right.
But there might be something wrong with wearing that dress to work.
Right. So it's two options, and both can be. They don't have any inherent positive or negative or good, bad, evil value to it. It's just these are options.
Exactly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
So do you see Voxer as a SaaS company? Is it a product company? Because as you were talking about, like, helping write the items and things like that, I see that there's a lot, it's very hands-on in terms of helping your clients. So that makes it more of a service. But at the end of the day, it's about here's the Voxer, here's your service.
Well, there's a process of user education. And there's also a shock of the new.
Sure.
That I think that it's going to get easier and easier for us. And more of our clients as we go forward are going to take it and run with it.
Mm-hmm.
We are trying to, again, have our cake and eat it too, that we're trying to be a SaaS company for big enterprise companies who don't do anything for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the high level executives of a lot of major companies are nothing more than vendor selectors. They do very, very little work themselves. So they hire big six or big four or however many there are these days of the accounting companies or law firms or whatever to basically do almost all of the work for them.
Mm-hmm.
There are other companies that are really a lot more hands-on. And then there's really much smaller companies, but they're nimble. And the reason they're so good is because they do things for themselves. They think for themselves. Obviously, there are some big companies that think for themselves, but in my judgment, they're the exception. But mm-hmm. we are starting out as a SaaS, as you said, out of necessity. There's a learning curve. But once people become familiar with this, once this becomes known and even mainstreamed, I think that people are going to see a scale that's similar or overlapping into their domain, and they're going to take the every scale that anyone creates in any of our verticals can
mm-hmm.
be in our suggestion list for every other client. So
right.
once someone comes up with a clever scale, it can be reused everywhere. So mm-hmm. it's going to get easier and easier and easier. We do want to move in a purely scalable plug-in software model.
Yeah.
As we go forward, but going out the gate, we have to be a SaaS.
Sure, yeah. Do you consider Voxer to be a startup?
You know, that's a funny word. We just had the experience of sponsoring the MIT Startup Spotlight.
Yeah.
So rather than sitting as one of the startup exhibitors at one of those tables, we were one of the sponsor tables.
Yeah.
And it was an enlightening experience because you get treated differently. Do judge that startup is a loaded term. In essence, it means that you have an idea and nobody's paying you enough for it yet, so you aren't sustainable. If you mm-hmm. say you're a successful business and you need capital to grow, and you don't mention the word startup at all, some companies still claim to be a startup. Google probably still claims to be a startup.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, but the I've developed more of a sensitivity to words.
Sure, absolutely.
In the course of doing this.
yeah. And I like to ask a lot of my guests that question because I think, yes, it's a term that gets thrown around. Startup is a term that gets thrown around. And I think, I agree that it's loaded. And I agree that different people have very different definitions of what it is. So I like to ask folks like that, especially folks who are in, I think, your your context, right? If you take the Matthew out of the equation and there was another founder CEO, that person may give a completely different response and say, yes, absolutely, Jen, we're a startup and here's why. Same context.
Well, and again, it comes back to what you define startup. I think that if you say that startups are in search of a sustainable business model that is specifically scalable, then yes. And that also applies to the idea of technology being disruptive, that we may be, we're solving problems that people haven't even articulated yet. We're solving curation problems. We're solving problems that'll make 3D browsing easier. The world of screens that we all look at now, where we mostly are divided up into desktops, laptops, mobile screens, and I guess a few tablets, although most people that I know who own tablets have had their tablets kidnapped by their toddlers and never got them back.
That's why we got a second tablet. I still use my iPad, but my son has his own.
But this constellation of screens that we're looking at right now is going to be totally different in 3 or 5 years. It's probably going to be more like that scene in Minority Report where you got that 3D screen and you're moving things around. The technology is already in place for a lot of that.
Right.
But in order for that to work, and this goes for a lot of the information in the world today, you need a meaningful way to filter and navigate multidimensional information. And that's where I think that we are way ahead of the curve. That we're making it possible for, the world has already solved the problem of data. You can get infinite amounts of data, you know, bounced by satellite to your tiny smartphone device that fits in your pocket when you're hiking the Himalayas.
Yep.
You can get every piece of real-time data about the stock market and et cetera. The problem is filtering out the signal from the noise. And no matter how good computers are, Google algorithm is the most powerful algorithm in the world, maybe, or some, by some measures, but it's still just giving you one dimension, best to worst, according to Google's search algorithm.
That's
so what's
right.
more meaningful than that is what humans thought. Yes, best to worst according to Google, and more relevant for this use case versus more relevant for that use case, and more of a pain in the ass to use versus easier to use. I mean, these are basically all sort of like a way, a filter, a reviewing of curating, I mean, a curation of data is a much bigger market than surveys. And that's one of the reasons that even though we're going out the gate with the slogan surveys that don't suck, that's just to get people's attention.
Sure.
But the bigger market that we're going after is curation.
Interesting. Interesting. What is your biggest people-related problem right now at Wox, or at least people-related challenge?
What isn't? Finding the right people. Finding good people, finding people who understand and can act on the mission, taking initiative. We don't want employees. We want partners. We want people who think for themselves. I don't know if it's something that can be taught. I'm not sure it can be described in a job description. There's a certain kind of hunger that comes with the kind of flexibility and question. I mean, if this goes back to, quote, being a startup. You are every single day trying to figure out answerable questions, pieces that you're hypothesizing and testing against, and you have to do it quickly.
Yes.
If you are not eliminating options, if you are not sorting out what works and what doesn't work in a systematic way, then you basically have a loud hobby, and if you succeed, it's because of dumb luck.
Yes. Right. So it's almost, you said something about asking questions. And so what that got me thinking about was it's not, you don't want, from my experience, from what I hear startup folks looking for too, for people who want to work for startups, I don't want someone who's just going to answer the questions. I want someone who's going to come up with the good questions that need answering, to take that initiative and to not just be able to think on your feet and make good, quick decisions, but to also take it all in and have that sort of big picture view too. That's like, okay, help me. What do we need to do next? Let's come up with these ideas. At least that's what my experience has been in thinking about. If I were to hire an intern, for example, for my business, I don't want someone who's going to be a robot and just tell them to do what I do. tell them to. Just do what I do. You know, do what I say. I mean, I want someone to help me think creatively about where should I go next and what's the next big question.
Yes, and we have the enviable and also torturous problem of having a technology with a lot of different applications.
Yeah.
And it's a curse in that you can really use Voxer. You can use it to get feedback on a customer service experience. You can use it to sort investment possibilities,
yeah,
have analysts at a finance firm do that. You can use it to get real-time feedback to an online course. You can use it to get real-time interactive feedback at a lecture or at a panel or at a conference. And for us, there's no technological pivoting involved, but
yeah,
each of those is a different product. So part of what we've been looking for is someone who understands how to productize a technology.
Right. Yeah, yeah. And really, so you're looking for like specific target markets, like who is this for? And then someone, once you decide that, someone who could productize it for that particular group of people.
Yes. And that goes back to a couple of the questions that you mentioned before. Sometimes survey results simply verify what we already assumed. Well, it's not simply verify. If you're asking this question in an in-depth way, mm-hmm, you're getting confirmation on something.
Sure.
You're getting confirmation on a hypothesis. That's priceless, especially in marketing where you never know anything. You know, the joke is, you know, mm-hmm, half the money you spend on marketing is wasted. You don't know which half.
Sure.
You just don't know which half. So now you know. Now you know that sure, that line worked. Now you know that that line didn't resonate.
Mm-hmm.
To be able to say what you say with a greater degree of certainty,
yeah,
when you're talking about the $3 billion a year that BMW spends on marketing.
Yeah, okay. That's an excellent point. To be able to say, I am 100% certain that this will work for you after you've asked.
Or I went from 20% certain to 75% certain.
I mean,
wow.
Yeah.
Wow, that's a huge difference.
Mm-hmm.
That's something that you should. And, you know, the other difference between smaller and bigger companies is that bigger companies, too many people are, you know, they're already making a lot of money. So a great deal of their thought and a great deal of the institutional imperative of their jobs is to protect what they are making. It's to,
mm-hmm,
avoid risk. Whereas, you know, smaller companies have nothing to lose. And so they're really trying to figure out how to take risks.
Sure.
So the kinds of questions and the kinds of risk takers and the champions that you find in each company are different.
Mm-hmm.
We've found that the CEO levels of these huge companies, mm-hmm, they're like, sure, yeah, let's do that. Put it up there. Put it on the website. Put it in our platform on the you know, auto show.
Uh-huh.
Whereas the lower level people have spent 6 months putting their internal company political capital towards a certain part of the website. There's this incredible long politicized process, whereas the CEO's like, I don't care, we're trying to sell cars. It's just a tiny accessory to do that. Change the website.
Mm-hmm.
They can think above it. But anyone lower level has all of these reasons to cover their ass. So mm-hmm, by empowering people with more accurate, in-depth data than they're currently getting, and I don't want to minimize that there are other indirect ways of gathering consumer data. The big data industry has made huge strides in giant, weird Big Brother ways,
mm-hmm,
you know, knowing our geolocation, knowing our purchasing patterns. I wish they didn't know all this about us, but they do. And some of that can provide incredibly accurate data about what people, quote, really think. But the human subjective is still, to me, the most important thing out of all of this.
Yeah.
So if we can give you that piece, then yeah, we are going to change the way the world thinks about thinking.
Yeah. And with that thought, we are just about up on time. So I want to thank you very much for taking the time to talk with us today. Thanks, Matthew.
My pleasure.
Yeah, great.
And that wraps up another episode of the PeopleStack podcast. Check out my website, jenbunk.com. That's JenBunk.com, where you can find lots of goodies, including a link to PeopleStack Academy, my online school dedicated to helping the tech community build better people processes. Also on JenBunk.com, you can sign up for the Change Log, the PeopleStack weekly email with tips and exclusive offers only available to my email tribe. Thanks for listening. Bye for now.